Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello, Rank Squad, and welcome to Ranks FC in the final one of our four previews ahead of this World Cup. This time, looking through groups J, K, and L. It feels weird even saying groups K and L, but this is the new tournament and what we've all got to get used to over the course of the next couple of weeks. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. And joining me across the pond, all the way from San Diego, is Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, I'm good. World Cup fever is setting in. Our second pod of the day, actually. We've recorded one today on Patreon. Our members have been giving their hot takes on what we should expect at the World Cup. Honestly, please do come over to the Patreon. We've got loads coming across this month, and you'll get raw takes. Obviously, we're still going to have pods coming out on the main feed, but on Patreon you're going to be getting some thoughts, some processing of what we're seeing as it happens, I think. So today in the hot takes was an insight into to what the Rank Squad are thinking. There was some wild stuff out there, but it was good fun to hear what people would like to see slash think could happen. But today we'll be a little bit more serious as we get stuck into the final groups.
I think that's right. You know, over the next couple of weeks, the Patreon is going to be where we're doing these kind of live, unfiltered reactions to games as they go in. Here on the main feed, probably be a little bit more thematic when we kind of takeaways from the games as a whole and a few more things that we're kind of trying to read into it, as opposed to, you know, direct reaction to game by game stuff. So if you're interested in hearing us jumping on the mic pretty much after the games and getting our kind of takes at the time and seeing how things react in real time, we'd love to have you over on the Patreon. The link, as ever, is in the description. And if you are over there, you can help to shape the content through this World Cup as well. We're going to be doing, you know, taking questions on pretty much every episode and making sure that everyone's voice is heard and all the topics you want to hear about are being talked about as well. But we've got plenty to get stuck into as well today, Dean. These last three groups include a couple of big dogs. Argentina, reigning champions, headline Group J. Obviously in Group K, Cristiano Ronaldo and Portugal. Is this finally their time? They go in with an incredible squad and feeling more confident perhaps than they ever have done before. And then in Group L, we're going to get your takes on England and whether it finally might come home, in inverted commas, for the first time since 1966. So let's start with Argentina, Dean. Reigning champions, winners of Qatar 2022. And they come in riding a relatively high wave, I think, in terms of not necessarily this season, but, you know, in this period, they have won back-to-back Copa Americas. They have won a World Cup in the middle. They come into this off the back of an unbelievable qualification campaign in CONMEBOL, where they finished 9 points clear of Ecuador, who ended up coming second. There is much of the same squad that was there last time out, Angel Di Maria being the main omission in terms of players who weren't there in 2022. But this feels like a very, very settled Argentina. And whilst they're not necessarily amongst the out-and-out favourites at the very top of the pile, my feeling on Argentina is their trophy not to win, is their trophy to defend, and good luck getting past them.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be retaining it, but I'm not going to rule it out. I think that's my stance coming into the tournament. Like you say, they finished top of CONMEBOL. They beat Brazil home and away. Like, that's always a marker of how well set you are coming into the big time.
First time ever, by the way, they've beaten Brazil away from home in a World Cup qualifier, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and you know, they've got a style of play which they've used throughout, which will carry them through into the tournament. No side had a higher average possession share in that qualifying period than Argentina. But this is a team that kind of keeps it for a reason, you know. They're not just all sideways and backwards across the back of the pitch. It will evolve. And once that ball gets into the middle, they've got players that can quickly transition it into their attack. You've got Julian Alvarez, you'll get Messi, they'll drop deep, they'll get on the ball, and then they all move forwards from there. Obviously, like, it's funny, on the Patreon, when you listen, you'll hear somebody questioning Messi's presence at the World Cup and whether he should be there. Look, he was probably Argentina's most influential player to getting to this point again. Right, it doesn't matter about his age. Like, he can just walk around and he'll still be more effective than pretty much anyone else on the planet will be. He'll make chances, he'll take chances. And that's what you want in an international tournament. It helps that he's got Julian Alvarez around him. And then he's got the likes of Lautaro and stuff to call upon as and when needed. I think that they have a decent chance. They've obviously got a nice platform here in the group stages as we go through it. They're going to win the group. Like, they're going to win the group. I think, to be honest, they're almost certain to get to the quarterfinals. Like, that's my hunch as I come into it. The quarterfinals is almost a no-brainer to me that they'll be at that point. And then do they make it through to the final four? Probably. Like, I actually am quite hot on them. Like, I like to question teams a lot once we see them defending a crown. And because of Messi being, is it 38? I'm right, yeah, 38.
He turns 39 during the World Cup.
Turns 39 during the World Cup. There's more reason to even think, like, surely he can't be as influential. But as I said at the top, I think he can. I don't know if Argentina make the final again, but I do. Half of me expects them to be in the final four.
I think what's interesting about this team is that, you know, if Messi is underpowered compared to 4 years ago, and I think that remains an if, like, his form has been pretty good coming into this. The question, I suppose, was, have they got a plan B? And when I was kind of ruminating on the answer to that, my hunch is that I think where it might be different is that this time they know they can play without him. That last time it felt like everything had to go through Lionel Messi. And look, that doesn't mean that if he's on the pitch, things aren't going to run through him. Of course they are, right? Like, when you have a player of that capacity, of that influence on a game of football, you're trying to get them into the best possible position. That's just how it operates and how this team is set up to operate. But I think that there is now more of a confidence that plan B is effectively, we can operate without Lionel Messi, and there are still an unbelievable amount of talented players in this squad. As we said before, most of them are world champions. And you have the same issue in some regards of replacing Di Maria on the other flank, who was really, really important to the way that Argentina played when they won it last time out. And somewhat surprisingly, I think, given his club form, I think it might well be Thiago Almada on that side. Now, he played, what, 25 minutes at the last World Cup? And you're thinking, okay, is that going to be something that lets them down in those kind of areas? He is no Angel Di Maria. Very few players are. But equally, he's a world champion. And he was a world champion at that age. When you're looking at these players, when they step onto the pitch in that Albiceleste shirt, so many of them have lifted this trophy, have been there, done it, and know what it feels like to have that medal around their necks and that trophy above their heads. They know what it feels like to have sewed the third star onto that Argentina shirt, the one that was craved for such a long period of time. And it gives them this sense of invulnerability. I think when they come out onto the pitch in these shirts, when they come out as part of the Scaloneta, they're looking at it all together, and this is such a compact group. It's such a tight-knit group. It feels like it's one that's been together for a long, long time. When players come in who are new players, someone like a Nico Paz, who is going to be very, very interesting, I think, if he gets opportunity to play and he's fully fit, which is a slight concern going into the World Cup. How do they operate without Messi? Well, maybe they play Lautaro and Julian Alvarez together at the top of the pitch. Maybe we see those two number nines who were battling for the shirt last time out actually utilized together, because there is more of a number nine battle this time, Dean. If you're looking at it in terms of where Lautaro was coming into Qatar, he was struggling with injuries. He started that first game, didn't play particularly well. Alvarez came screaming in and felt like so much more of a fit with the rest of the team that he effectively was given the nods for the rest of the tournament. This time, Lautaro is fit and firing. Alvarez has had a funny up and down season. He's also potentially the most in-demand player in the entirety of Europe right now, considering that Real Madrid have apparently just had a 150 million euro bid rejected by Atletico. But they do have options to kind of mix this up and change it up if they need to. I don't think they will necessarily have to do that, but I think they're confident and comfortable in the fact that they can make those rotations without it being at the complete detriment of the side.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's also with this team, you know, they've got an underlying strength in the young players that they've got coming through to support the cast that have won and they're of a very high level. So I think competition for places is good in that sense too, because in this group stage, I think they do get a chance to properly utilize the squad. I don't think they have to use all those top level players, particularly the ones that have are either getting on or have had a hard season. And so it's just for me and another asset that they've got that other teams are not going to have. Like Scaloni's said that Argentina aren't going to the World Cup to win it, that they're going to go to defend it. I don't know exactly what the difference is there, but what we do know is that you are the team that everybody wants to beat. You are the team that everyone wants to knock out because it's such a scalp to take you. And I don't think they'll go through the tournament unbeaten necessarily. I think it's plausible, actually, that... Well, I don't know if they'll lose one of the group. I think they could drop points in one of the group games. I don't. Their group is such that 9 points is definitely possible. But they will struggle at some point in the tournament. But because of the quality that they've got, I think that they are ready for everything that comes their way.
I suppose my only real question is form, right? And I think the form in particular of the midfield three, Enzo Fernandez, who's probably in the best nick of these three that I'm about to name, and then Alexis McAllister and Rodrigo De Paul, they're likely to kind of run that back, right? Like it's likely to be the three in midfield again. It normally becomes a four sometimes in a kind of 4-4-2 off the ball with one of them, normally De Paul coming out to that right-hand side to make sure that they cover. But I do wonder if there is a little bit of scope for that to change throughout the tournament if one of those players doesn't show their full potential or full capability. And again, you know, sometimes when players just step on to the pitch in that shirt, it feels a little bit different to what it does when they've been playing for their clubs and they kind of come away from all of the issues that have been surrounding various teams over the course of this season. But... you know, you're looking at a midfield three there that was the envy of the world last time out. And this time around doesn't feel like it's coming in with the same kind of impetus, doesn't feel like it's coming in with the same kind of power, perhaps, at their disposal. And I suppose what's going to be interesting is whether Scaloni sticks with what he did last time, which was, okay, Lautaro didn't start well. We're going to change it up and kind of shift the kind of balance in order to get the team and the kind of component parts all working together, or whether he sticks with these guns because they have ultimately delivered him a trophy before.
Yeah, it's a dilemma, isn't it? A nice dilemma, for sure. But, you know, like last time around, like it wasn't like they won it easily. It was one of the most difficult routes to winning a World Cup you could have. Like, considering what they went through in the group stages last time around, considering the up and down nature of the final that they had to endure. This was never a team that was like completely dominant in the first place. It's that they had to dig deep. And exactly the thing is going to apply to them across this tournament that they're about to begin in defense. I do think I have to say that it's a nice start for them playing Algeria. That will be the game that they begin with on June 16. And I do think that that's a good one for them to get up and running with.
Yeah, no, look, I've got some thoughts on Algeria that we'll come to in a second, but it does just feel to me like this is a team who are willing to go, okay, we might not be the best team here, but equally, we are not going to be easy to roll over for absolutely anyone. And that's a very difficult prospect when a team is coming in feeling very, very comfortable. Obviously, they won the Copa America here as well. They'll feel very, very comfortable in this place. There'll be a massive Argentine support, as there was in Qatar. And we'll get to see if they can become the first team ever to retain the trophy outside of their own continent. That would be the one that comes up when you talk about these ones. And the first to do it since about the 1960s, if I'm not mistaken. But Scaloneta are here again, and I think are going to be a mighty task for anybody to overhaul. This group for a while looked like it might just be teams beginning with A, Dean. Argentina were drawn, and then Algeria were drawn, and Austria were drawn before Jordan kind of mucked it up in terms of the party and naming it in those conventions at the very least. But let's come on to Austria. I want to get to Algeria in a minute. Another one to return to this stage for the first time since 1998. They last won a World Cup game in 1990. It has been a long absence from victory on the World Cup stage for Austria, but this feels like a team that's been turned around in the last 4 years to me. Ralf Rangnick's now been there for pretty much this entire cycle. He set them on a good trajectory. They were good at the last Euros, a little bit unlucky to go out to Turkey in the round of 16. I thought they dominated large spells of that game and perhaps should have been a little bit more clinical with their own chances. They're fun. They like to attack. It feels like their players and fans all very much on side with what the manager is trying to do. But I think that they come into this with a point to prove after being absent for such a long period of time.
Yeah, I think so too. A lot of people will quite fancy them. And I think that this is an opportunity for them to start fresh and to show a playing style and an identity that shows that this isn't going to be the end. This isn't just a one-off appearance. This is something that they are looking to build on, and they've had decent success of putting results together recently that show that they could make a mark here. Now, ultimately, just the fact that they've qualified is like great for the country. Like, they needed to be back on this stage again. And when you're like that, in that situation, you kind of limit like what is possible from here in terms of predicting, I guess, how far you go. But you do know that they're going to have a decent chance of getting through the group. They'll face Jordan first, and I expect them to win that game. They've only got these three games. At the moment, as they head into it, you think, right, we've got three games. We've got to go and win one. We've got to go and win one to give ourselves a chance. And that's why I get an impression. I spoke earlier again, I think it was on the Patreon today, about teams taking risk. There's got to be some teams that go there and try to assert themselves a little bit and, of course, be compact. Of course, not take silly risks in game one. But when you've got an opportunity like this one, you do need to make sure that you play front-footed football at some stage. And I think that Austria have the capabilities in their lineup to go and do that.
I think this group might genuinely be quite a fun one to watch, because I think there will be a lot of focus put on by at least three of these teams in terms of getting on the ball and starting to try and dominate. Now, obviously, game states change and, you know, you have slightly different game plans for all these different opponents, fine. But I think that Austria and Algeria, to an extent, will very much look to play their game and impose it on, at the very least, each other and Jordan, if maybe not Argentina, to the same extent. One of the questions I suppose I have is how much this counter-press stands up in the heat. Because the first game that Austria play is in Santa Clara. They play at the Niners Stadium. That's going to be very, very hot. Then the second one against Argentina is probably for the best, because that's the one at AT&T, and that's going to have a closed roof, so that's going to be climate controlled. That will allow them to play that game a little bit more aggressively, you'd imagine. And then in that final game, they're in Kansas City, which is going to be absolutely boiling for that game against Algeria, which is a massive game in so many different ways, especially if they've both won a game in the first two. That opens it up, but it's also an opportunity for Algeria to potentially avenge the disgrace of Gijon from 1982, which saw them eliminated at the hands of West Germany and Austria at the time, who basically played out a 1-0 win for West Germany that took both teams into the next section of the World Cup. It is one of those things that's kind of part of Algerian football folklore as one of the things that's happened against them. An opportunity to avenge that will always, always, always be something that kind of lights a fire under a certain generation as well. But just to kind of round off on Austria, they've had a couple of big blows. I think Christoph Baumgartner losing out to injury on the eve of the tournament. They've decided they're not going to replace him in the squad is a massive blow. He's had an absolutely phenomenal individual campaign for Leipzig, been one of the players of the season by my money. And he was a really, really big part of what they were doing in the last Euros. Now, they have some interesting replacements here in two players who have recently declared their allegiance, Kani Chukwuemeka and Paul Vanner, who was at Bayern and now finds himself at PSV. They look much more important as switches with Baumgartner out. I'm a little bit concerned about their ability to score goals. Marko Arnautovic, 37 years old now, leading the line, and he's going to have to find some big, big moments, I think, for this to work. There have been, you know, players who have stepped up for Austria in a number of different ways. But I think that whilst I'm a little bit concerned about their sharpness at that end of the pitch, the midfield sort of engine room, Niklas Seewald, Xaver Schlager, and then Conny Leimer coming in from left back and inverting off that side to add an extra body in there is about as solid and well put together as you could possibly ask for. And I think that that's going to be the basis of everything that comes good about Austria at this tournament.
Yeah, exactly, mate. It's going to be high pressure, high intensity, but just looking to make sure that they have still got that creative spark that they can't afford to be missing. If they do win the ball high up the field, like, it's very quick decision-making that leads to a goal.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. I mean, let's come on to Algeria. This is a very, very, very talented side, but it's also one that hasn't really been tested very much. They blitzed through qualification. They scored a bucket load of goals, but it was a really, really kind draw. And they would it would have been absolute uproar if they had not effectively just comfortably won out to guarantee qualification in the group that they were given. AFCON is probably the best example of competitive football that we've seen them in. They were loads of fun at the start of this year. They played some absolutely gorgeous football, and then they fell apart against Nigeria in the quarterfinals. They were missing Hussein Awar at that point, who will probably play deeper here to start to dictate alongside him. Hisham Boudouai is a really, really important player. Plugs the gaps, covers grass, really kind of smart footballer who allows the technical geniuses in this team to do what they do best. I think that there's a lot to like about this team. Vladimir Petkovic, the manager, is a smart, well-versed international coach, capable of upsets. He was in charge of the Switzerland team that knocked out France in the Euros 5 years ago. And he will absolutely demand that his team are physically sharp as well as the technical capabilities that we already know that they have. But there are some weaknesses that I'm concerned about. They've not had a stable goalkeeper in this cycle. It looks like it's going to be Lucas Zidane, son of Zinedine, who is going to start between the sticks for Algeria. He doesn't inspire a whole bucket load of confidence as far as I'm concerned, but neither do any of the other options, really. And the centre-back partnership of Rami Bensbaini and Issa Mandi is very, very good on the ball, slightly less so off it. But there's positives too. And look, Riyad Mahrez is going to grab headlines, right, on that right-hand side. Still there, the captain of this team at this point. But I think that something that might end up being a decisive factor for them is how much their left-hand side operates. Because in Ibrahim Maza and Mohamed Amoura, I think they have two players who could be absolute revelations if that link-up works down that left-hand side. There will be eyes on Mahrez. There'll be eyes on Amin Guiri as well, who probably starts through the middle. But for me, if this team are going to succeed, it's about how much they can get that link between Maza and Amoura working to an extent where they have genuine goal threats on both sides of the pitch.
Yeah, it's going to be about balance for sure in terms of quality, but also in terms of the younger players that you've got to blend with the experienced heads and knowing what the levels of trust are, I think. Like you say, there is an elitism about them to some degrees, but I genuinely don't know what we're going to get. I don't know how much I actually trust Algeria to come together this quickly because they've got the toughest possible start. Like, you're playing against the champions, the reigning champions who are going to look to make an impression, Argentina, and you're going to lose. Like, Algeria are going to lose that game almost certainly. If they can get anything out of that game, it's huge. Like, to even lose it narrowly would, to be honest, would be a success. Now, I'm not saying I don't expect Argentina to go and win that game 5-0, and I'm not trying to be condescending here, but it is, like, obviously, to play a World Cup, your opener against the team that are defending their crown is less than ideal. But the good news for them is you're playing at the highest possible standard you could get at the World Cup, and then your next game is against Jordan. And that's your opportunity. Because if you can maintain the levels that you were having to show to try and get something from a game against Argentina and play to that level, then you have got a good chance of getting the points in the bag that you need in that second game. And then it might all come down to Austria. I'll be totally honest. I think Algeria might end up being one of the best third place teams. Like, that's kind of where I'm positioning them myself. But I know that some people fancy them to do a bit better than that. We'll have to wait and see. I genuinely don't know yet.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that they have a genuine shot coming second in this group, but it's probably going to take, you know, a really, really impressive result against one of Austria or Argentina to actually make that happen. So we will see. I mean, look, let's just quickly come on to Jordan. And I think that for Jordan, unlike a lot of the newcomers, they'll probably look at this group with a little bit of excitement. They had a really smooth qualification process. They've been banging on the door for a little while. They finished second to South Korea, and it never really, to me, felt like it was in doubt. They're a side that are very comfortable in what they're doing. They are going to play a 3-4-3. There's a lot of focus on a stable core, and even more focus, I think, in terms of quick transitions and getting the ball into a couple of very, very dangerous forwards. Notably, Moussa Altamari of Rennes. He's the star man. He shone in Cyprus. He had a very good short campaign in Belgium. Then he made the move to Montpellier, where he was picked up by Rennes. And I think he's had a very, very impressive season there as well. Sadly, they are missing a couple of attacking stars through injury. And Yazan Al-Naimat, who's been a very talismanic figure for them, has been there throughout this entire process. He did his ACL in a game against Saudi Arabia back in December and will be missing. But Ali Olwan has recovered in time to lead the line. It was his hat-trick against Oman that brought Jordan here and guaranteed their qualification to the World Cup for the first time. Their coach, Jamal Salami, came in about 2 years ago. He's done a very, very good job. He took them to the final of the Arab Cup in 2025. They lost on penalties to Morocco, which sounds slightly better, I think, than it is. That's a changed Morocco side that tends to travel to the Arab Cup. But still, to get there and put themselves in that position was an achievement, I think, within itself. There are a lot of people that are going to underestimate this Jordan side. And we're not quite sure exactly how the quality stacks up, but I think that they are one of those sides, and we'll talk about another one in DR Congo a little bit later, who are quite well positioned to place themselves as underdogs, because they will come in knowing that they're going to play that three at the back. They're going to be able to drop those fullbacks who are quite attack-minded in for much of this one and just try and get the ball quickly into those dangerous players in the front areas. They almost certainly are still going to finish bottom of what is a tricky group, but I give them more of a puncher's chance than perhaps I do to some of the other newcomers.
Well, they don't have the same pressure as some nations, which I think is good because everyone is predicting that they come bottom of the group. And, you know, they might as well take that for what it is and just be like, right, the only way is up from here. I think they'll be defensively resolute. And then it's about how they make the most of those breakaways, how they can transition, how quick they can be, and ultimately how accurate they can be when those chances fall. They're not going to get that many chances per game against any of the three teams, I don't think, that they face. But they will get chances. So are they going to fall to the right people at the right time? That's ultimately what it's going to come down to, small margins. In that first game against Austria, they're going to try and keep it tight. They're going to try and keep it 0-0. Even if they're 1-0 down, still having a chance in the late stages to snatch something from that will be crucial. So I think that we, in that first game, we'll probably see a tight affair as long as they don't concede very early on.
Yeah, no, I agree. And look, they are going to very much try to sit in and hit you on the counter. That's where they will feel that they're most confident. And also, that's a good way to be coming into a tournament because they're not having to adapt their entire philosophy to, you know, to try and suddenly, you know, stay in games. If you're a side, and again, we'll talk about some more of them later, who are built on a keeping the ball philosophy or playing out from the back philosophy, and you ultimately just don't have the quality of player to do that against higher ranked opposition, you're more than likely going to struggle. I think that they will be able to play their natural game. Whether that's enough or not, I don't know. But I think that that will give them, at the very least, a puncher's chance in a couple of these games. And, you know, if they get off to a good start, who knows where that could take them. But that will do us for Group J. When we come back on the other side, we're going to be talking about Group K, Portugal, Colombia, DR Congo, and Uzbekistan. Make sure you stick with us here on Ranks FC. Welcome back to Ranks FC and our final preview ahead of the World Cup, covering Groups J, K, and L. We've done Group J, onto Group L, which includes Portugal, Colombia, DR Congo, and Uzbekistan. We'll start with Portugal, Dean. Their seventh straight World Cup appearance, ninth overall. Their most recent kind of run at a World Cup that was of serious note was coming fourth in 2006, although they did come third back in 1966. And it was a relatively easy qualifying. They won the games that they needed to win. They had a little bit of a wobble when they drew to Hungary and lost to Ireland in a game that didn't really make much sense whatsoever. They scored 14 goals in two games against Armenia. They've had a little bit of red card drama with Cristiano Ronaldo when he was suspended. That has been removed, so he will not miss the first game of the World Cup, as FIFA, I'm sure, are absolutely delighted about. Roberto Martinez in charge took over in 2023. They got to the quarterfinals in Euro 24. He was under real, real pressure in 2025. It looked like Jose Mourinho was waiting in the wings to take over the national team. And then he won the Nations League. And suddenly there was a whole swell of confidence in him again. I mean, maybe more than anything, this is an unbelievably talented Portugal squad in almost every single area. The depth that they have, the quality they have been a production line. If you look at Porto and Olival and Seychelles at Benfica and what's going on at Sporting as well, they have completely and utterly brought through an entire new generation of Portuguese talent. It's being backed up at the unders level. It doesn't look like slowing down anytime soon. And look, there are Portuguese fingerprints across pretty much all of the big clubs in Europe at this point. The question, I suppose, Dean, is can they pull it all together on the biggest stage of all?
Well, I think they've got a good chance to get off to a very positive start here and build confidence. The squad is phenomenal. Like the strongest 11 is brilliant. The depth options are great. They've got a coach I don't wholly believe in yet in terms of like taking them the full way. But he's got plenty of experience now, Martinez. And if there was going to be a time, then this is his time because he's got hold of another golden gen. And it's an opportunity to show himself in the best light he's ever been capable. Obviously, as a coach, he's got a good record, he's got a good reputation, but there's always been that talk of like, could he become one of the best? And I've always had my doubts about him in that respect, but this is something he's desperate to make his mark on. The obvious questions are going to be around Ronaldo and whether he deserves to be in the team. And if he's not in the team, then why is he not in the team? And that's undoubtedly going to be an issue. The thing is, their first two games at the World Cup are against Congo and Uzbekistan. Mate, that is, from their perspective, just your chance to go out there and set the tone for your tournament. Like, that's as good as you could hope for. I'm not saying that like those two teams are just going to let him have it all their own way. Like it might not be 6-0, 6-0, but if Portugal are at the top of their game from the first whistle, it could be. Like they have the capability of setting the tone for this tournament.
No, I think it's really interesting with Portugal in that, you know, you come into this and we're discussing kind of different elements. We've talked about teams with depth areas, but right now, if Portugal fields a midfield three of Vitinha, João Neves and Bruno Fernandes, is there a player on earth that they would swap any of those three for right now? And I think the answer is...
It's the best. Like, that combination, Vitinha and João Neves, we already know. And then you're throwing in the Premier League Player of the Year. Well, officially. But like, it's just perfect for them. And then what are you getting ahead of that? And obviously there are combinations. Say you went Leao, Ronaldo, Neto, for example. Like, it's just so nice, mate. And the way that they're going to conduct themselves, the combinations of play are great. And the thing that's even better is that when some teams, you'll look at them and you'll be like, oh, but defensively, are they going to be strong enough? Yeah. Are they going to keep the ball enough? Yeah. Are they going to make the most of the possession? Probably, yeah. Like, so...
Well, that's the question. That is the question.
It's probably the biggest question is, will they make the most of it? But probably... I think certainly in the group stage they will. The group stage, like that, and that's what I talk about in terms of momentum, confidence, start, chance to set the tone for the tournament. Because those teams, like, are going to be vulnerable if you manage to take authority in those games, and that is exactly what Portugal have the opportunity to do here. I'll tell you what, if we get to, like, the Colombia game is obviously quite a tough one, but it's game three and it's not going to matter really, is it?
Well, it shouldn't.
It shouldn't matter. And so they might even be using that game to kind of give players a rest, give somebody a game, which is an unbelievable chance for them to be in because they'll be probably topping the group and playing a best third place team. So they'll have got, they potentially get four games into the tournament without really breaking sweat, but managing to build unity and togetherness and combinations. I don't think Portugal win this competition, but I tell you what, they've got an unbelievable chance to go out and build momentum in a way that some of the other sides probably won't be able to do.
I mean, look, there have been questions asked of this Portuguese defence in kind of years and months gone by. If Ruben Dias is fit, he's obviously an unbelievable option to have back there. I love Gonçalo Inácio. I think he's a wonderful player and has really made that transition from playing in a five at the back to a four at the back that makes him, one, more incredibly useful for this team, but also boosts his value, I think, in a potential big mover off the back of this tournament this summer. If Portugal do go far and he is a starter, they have really nice backup in there, Tomás Araújo. Has been a very interesting player, has probably superseded his clubmate at Benfica, Antonio Silva, for that second spot. But when you're kind of looking at it and thinking, you know, where are the weaknesses? Potentially a little bit of right back. You know, Diogo Dalot's had a very solid season. On the left-hand side, Nuno Mendes is amongst the best in the world, right? And this is where I think Portugal will become really, really interesting because Diogo Costa is maybe not amongst the best in the world, but he's a very, very, very good shot stopper and a penalty saving expert. He has been very comfortable and within this team and the kind of locked in number one for some time now. There is still, I think, a little bit of surprise that he's still playing his club football at Porto, although I expect that to be tested a little bit this summer as well. But if you're talking about players that are best in class in their position, you have Nuno Mendes in this side, you have Vitinha in there, you have João Neves in there, you have Bruno Fernandes in there. I think you'd probably still make an argument for someone like a Bernardo Silva. I think you could make an argument for someone like a Ruben Dias. There is, you know, as much quality in this team as almost in anyone else. The question is going to be, can they actually make it all tick? And where does it leave them up from? Because whilst you can try and get away from that conversation, and we try to, and talk about the rest of it, the ultimate question over Portugal is going to be, does it all work together with Cristiano up front at this point in his career, at this age? And look, I think that there is a more nuanced discussion to what's happening here than sometimes is given shrift. No one has put their hand up and said, I am going to be the Portugal number nine of this next generation and done enough to dethrone a player who is probably, And I suppose it kind of depends on your club affiliations, but almost certainly the greatest Portuguese player of all time, very possibly the greatest European player of all time. And until someone sticks their hand up and says, no, that's my spot, and there's no way that when, you know, you're having it. And look, they tried to make an approach for Eli Junior Krupe before his World Cup, who is eligible for Portugal. He said no, he wants to wait and see if he can get into the France squad. Maybe that's someone who comes in and goes, oh, okay, if you're bringing me in to do this, I'm starting. But I don't think Gonçalo Ramos, as good a player as he is, can have too many complaints about not starting in this tournament when he doesn't start for his club in the biggest games. And that, I think, is part of the discussion that sometimes gets missed when we're talking about Portugal.
Yeah, and the other thing is, obviously, once we get to the knockout, scoring goals in terms of Ronaldo, like, not scored a knockout goal at a World Cup. It's one of the few things he hasn't done in his life. And because he hasn't done that, I'm going to assume that it's one of the things that does motivate him at this World Cup to make sure he is still in that starting lineup by the time we get out of the groups. And it might even be one of the reasons we see him perhaps sit out some of that group stage. You know, it wouldn't surprise me if he plays a bit part at his own choice in part of that group stage period so that he is available once they are into the rounds of 32, because he's only got to get through to that first knockout game to put that stat to bed. It's another thing that he can lay to rest. And because the opposition they're going to be up against isn't going to be like super elite, is a good chance of him actually breaking it. Portugal will be just outside. I think most people have like their top five favourites. I think most people would sit Portugal just outside of that.
Yeah, I think I'd probably have them about fifth. It's probably,
I think I'd have them sixth or seventh.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is an absurdly talented squad. There are a couple of question marks, I think, in terms of who plays in the wide areas. Obviously, Rafa Leão was given the nod in that game against Chile and managed to get himself sent off in that game for having a fight, which is not ideal for pretty much anyone. I think he's going to be given the all clear to play, but whether Bobby Martinez decides he's going to stick with him or not after that kind of loss of head in that friendly, like, that's exactly where we're at. Leão at this point should be a Ballon d'Or contending player, and he's just never really put it all together. And that for me is a huge frustration, because we know how talented he is, but also, where do Portugal go in these areas? Because look, João Félix is still having a very, very good campaign. He's had a really, really well linked up campaign with Cristiano Ronaldo in Saudi Arabia. But equally, is that enough to step onto this stage? Bernardo Silva's had a brilliant campaign, but mostly in central midfield for Manchester City. Does he play on the right-hand side and just use him as an option to kind of tighten things up? Maybe Cancelo plays at right back and they use Bernardo to tuck inside and get Cancelo into the game that way. And then on the left-hand side, you know, Leão, Pedro Neto, Chico Conceição is a game-changer, game-breaker, someone that Roberto Martinez clearly really, really likes. But, you know, all of them and Gonçalo Guedes, who is actually going to be the number one choice to start that first game, I do think is a slight worry that we don't know at this point for Portugal. And that for me is maybe the only place that this side falls apart a little bit. Let's come on to Colombia. Back at the World Cup, they missed out in 2022. They were quarterfinalists back in 2014 in Brazil. They did okay in CONMEBOL qualifying. They picked up 7 wins, 7 draws, and they had a couple of very, very good kind of straight up stand up fights with Argentina, which both teams came out of unbeaten. And Nestor Lorenzo took over in 2022. He's been very, very capable. He's brought a disparate group back together. And it feels like he's just allowing a few of these players to run riot again. Luis Diaz is now the main man of this team. It was James Rodriguez for such a long period of time. James will still be there. James is still going to be influential. James is still going to be important. But this feels like Luis Diaz's team now. And if he is given that freedom on that left-hand side to effectively not have to do those defensive duties, he's been given a midfield three behind him that almost certainly is just going to sit and make sure that no one is getting through it. You know, Richard Rios, Jefferson Lerma, a couple of really talented players in this pack to just tuck in behind whoever nominally plays 10, allow for Luis Diaz to drift onto that left-hand side and allow Daniel Munoz on the right-hand side to fly forward and make things happen. I'm quite excited to see what this Colombia side looks like. And if they're able to just turn that dial up a little bit as it comes to World Cup, I'm more hot on them than I am on perhaps a Uruguay.
Yeah, I'm more hot on them than Uruguay too, for sure. I mean, you're starting to learn this about me, I think, from doing a few podcasts with me this week. I really like Colombia for a number of reasons. I feel like this is, like, you always have like a tendency to have a fondness for Brazil at a World Cup, and it just feels right that you see Brazil and the way that they play. Colombia have that for me too. Like, they bring such colour and noise to the fixture, but they also bring a flamboyancy and a unique style of play always to a World Cup game. Like, we don't, you know, we're so used to seeing Premier League football from our standpoint, and Colombians are just a bit braver to play a bit differently, and they'll play passionately and they'll play emotionally for sure as well. But I think that this team is looking to make up for lost time as well. And I think that with that in the back of their minds, they'll want to kind of make a mark on this tournament. I think they've got an extremely good chance of getting out of this group. And then it's a case of how far can they go from there. My hunch is that we're looking at a team that get to the quarterfinals. That's kind of where that probably is their ceiling, to be honest. That's as far as I could see them go. But also, I have almost an expectancy that that's how far this team can go. I think they've got a little bit of everything. And as long as they don't slip up in that first game against Uzbekistan, then I'm going to be willing to trust them to do that.
I mean, I think the other thing that goes in Colombia's favour is that they have finally discovered a number nine in Luis Suarez, not that one, who has been brilliant for Sporting this year and looks like he's about to make a big move to Turkey off the back of this World Cup. If the elections go correctly, I think it's for Fenerbahce, they've agreed a deal to bring him to the Super League. But, you know, it did feel like that was a problem because John Duran kind of came in, burned really brightly for about 15 minutes and then burned out. And then suddenly they were like, oh God, who is actually going to lead this line? And he was given an opportunity in that final World Cup qualifier with Colombia already qualified. He scored 4 goals and was like, here you go, I'm the man. I'm the guy that's going to lead this line. And ultimately it looks like he is going to now be a starting striker at this World Cup, which is a real turnaround of events. There's loads of creativity here, right? Like the midfield three of Arias and Richard Rios are very talented, and they sit in front of Jefferson Lerma, who does all of the hard yards, all of the dirty work, and such an understated but very, very underrated player as well, I think both for Palace and for this Colombia side. But actually, those two in the middle who are given license to get forward and potentially help support the players in front of them, whether that be James or someone like Juanfer Quintero, who will play that 10 if James isn't capable of maybe staying at this level for as long as he has been in the past. He rolled back the clocks at the Copa America in 2024. No reason he can't do so again, even if his Minnesota spell was bitterly, bitterly disappointing. But you're kind of looking at it and thinking, right, there's attacking fullbacks, there's long, rangy defenders, there's set piece threat. I don't think that they are going to, you know, come out here and blitz everyone and be semi-finalists, but I think that they should have more than enough capability to make at the very least 2 rounds of the knockout stages.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's exactly what we should be expecting of them. And I think that's absolutely what they should be expecting of themselves too.
Yep, 100%, 100%. Okay, that takes us on to the other two teams in this group. Let's go to DR Congo. It has been a long, long time, 52 years away from the World Cup. They qualified in 1974, back when the country was still called Zaire. But this is their first appearance as DR Congo and just their second World Cup appearance overall. There are ghosts from 74 that hang a little bit over this team. They went out in the group stage that year. They had three losses. They didn't score a goal and they conceded 14. Perhaps the most iconic moment of that, running out of a wall and kicking a free kick away before it was taken. But you look at it and you think that they got here in some pretty dramatic fashion. They played in a group which also included Senegal, and they basically had a couple of slip-ups, including to Sudan, I think it was, early doors, that meant that it was very, very difficult for them to qualify automatically. They then ended up in the playoffs. They beat Cameroon 1-0 with 91st minute winner, which was a big one. And then they beat Nigeria on penalties in what has become a pretty famous shootout for some of the wild things that were going around outside at the voodoo and all of the above. That took them into an intercontinental playoff against Jamaica, where finally Axel Tuanzebe scored the goal in a pretty gritty encounter that ended up beating them in extra time. So they've taken the long way to get here, DR Congo. But one of the things I think they're really interesting, Dean, is because of what I was talking about earlier, they are a team set up to defend and counter, right? They're going to play with two banks of four. They're going to play with Vissa and Bakambu up top to try and make things happen. Elia on the right is a very talented, very tricky player who can get forward and make things happen at speed. They are going to look to sit in, frustrate teams and hurt them on the counter. That's how they've played all the way through their qualification process. And that is not going to change coming into the World Cup. And for me, I think that makes them a slightly dangerous underdog because they're very, very comfortable doing the thing that you have to do if you are going to get a result against a team which has a superior talent base to what you do.
Yeah, I mean, they're still going to be up against it. We can hype them up as much as we want, but they've got an extremely difficult task here, and it's all going to be about resilience, about game plans, about fitness. It's the harsh realities of World Cup football, and especially the challenge that they've got in their first game to get things up and running. It's going to be tough. I'd like to be able to build them up, but it's difficult, mate, isn't it? It's difficult.
I think what's interesting here is that they have enough quality to really kind of muck it up, if you will, in the defensive line. You know, Chancellor Mbemba has been there a long, long time. He captains his side. He's alongside Tuanzebe. They're both players with, you know, plenty of Premier League experience between them. Wan-Bissaka will start at right back. It's probably Arthur Masuaku at left back. Then in the middle, you've got Noah Siddiqui, Sam Mutsami, who I think is a wonderful player, hugely, hugely underrated, now playing his trade in the Greek league with the Tromitos, but a really interesting player. Charles Pickle as well, Espanyol, can come in there and make things happen. They are not going to try and be pretty, right? They are going to come in here and they're going to be like, right, try and break us down if you can. There's going to be a lot of kind of breaking the game down. There's going to be a lot of stopping it. There's going to be a lot of kind of making the dark arts work in some regards, but that will suit them because that's the way that they've, you know, kind of known how to play. And I think that for me, that is a positive when you compare it to the other kind of underdog in this group, which is Uzbekistan, right? They're here at their first World Cup. This is a long, long, long-term project. We've seen success for them at the unders levels. They've missed out a couple of times very, very, very narrowly. They missed out by a goal, I think, in 2014. Then they went to 2018 to a playoff against South Korea, and they missed out on that one. They were very, very good in qualifying. They were stuck in relatively sticky group that included Iran. And then they kind of came into that one and were like, okay, they played them four times, I think, in the course of qualification. They drew with them four times. And that's an Iran team that we talked about, that, you know, having a genuine chance of punching above their weight. They got through a group and ultimately with Qatar and the UAE in order to qualify. What I think is interesting, and the kind of counter argument, I suppose, to DR Congo, Dean, is that this was a team that fundamentally wanted to play football, right? That kept the ball, that they can play. They play out from the back. They're a lovely side to watch for much of it. The flip of it is that they now have realized, I think, that that's not the way they're going to win at a World Cup. So they brought in Fabio Cannavaro to be the manager. Now, his managerial CV is pretty checkered, to say the least. But when you're looking at it under the context of, this is a team which is mostly exclusively from the region. Quite a lot of them play in Iran, which, as we said in that preview, is an issue because that league's been suspended since February. and kind of already spoken about the fact that players are coming in here without the required match fitness to do what he wants. So we might see a little bit of a shift here in terms of how they play. They've played mostly with a four at the back before. Will they move to a three? Are they going to be comfortable playing in a much more defensively minded system than what they've done? There are a couple of major talents. Abdulkadir Kuzunov, the obvious kind of poster boy of this side, playing for Manchester City, wonderful centre back, very, very quick, very physically strong, and someone who's going to be expected to be the leader of this team for the next generation. And then at the other end of the pitch, they have Elder Shamuradov, who is still on loan from Roma in sort of a wild world, but he's been at Istanbul Bahakshir. He's been very, very good this season. And I think that if they are going to get something out of this tournament, it's going to be him up front, making the ball stick. A couple of talented players behind him, Masharapov in particular, who plays for Estegal, is a very, very, very talented footballer. If they are going to find success in the final third, it's probably going to be a combination of those two off a slightly more direct football than perhaps we've been used to in the qualification.
Yeah. Goes without saying that they've got a tough task. I mean, Kuzunov as a leader, he's only 22 years old. And like, yes, he's very good. Yes, he's at a level that most of his teammates are probably never going to reach. But he is only 22. And he's going from being an emerging player at Man City to a player that's kind of being leaned on for his experience and quality. That's difficult. I think he'll enjoy it because he's a very, very strong-minded individual. He'd already been through tough times at Man City and overcome them very quickly. And I think he's one of the most resilient players actually I've ever seen from that standpoint. I've got a lot of time for him. But it is a bit tricky when you're talking about him being the leader of a team. Look, if you're looking for a Cannavaro-type figure, then there's probably worse examples to look for in world football than somebody who can try and replicate that and take a team forward. But ultimately, let's see if the first two games are Colombia and then Portugal, and that's not ideal, is it? But it does mean if you can get a point against Colombia or Portugal, then you go into that game against Congo knowing a win takes you through, probably. And
no, it would. 4 points will take you through. I'm like pretty absolutely guaranteed. I think 4 points. It's not like logically it can happen that someone with 4 points could go. It's just not going to. I don't think. And so I think we're in a space where 4 points almost guarantees qualification. The other thing is that you can qualify on three. And there's a lot of teams, I think, who will qualify on three. And something that this format does give us is that if the DR Congo and Uzbekistan both lost their opening two games, which, you know, I think the bookies would tell you is likely, when you actually look at it, both of them will go into that final day saying, a win could take us into the knockout stages here. They'll have to go at each other a little bit more. And that does mean that those final days might be very, very exciting in those groups where it is kind of straight shootouts for potentially third place on the final day. So I'm looking forward to seeing them. I'm looking forward to seeing the adaptation, seeing what Cannavaro has managed to do with this side. But ultimately, I wonder if they will be able to compete with the physicality that's prominent in this group, not just in Portugal and Colombia, where it's obviously kind of the two elite sides you would name here, but also in this Congo side who are going to absolutely scrap to death for every single ball. And I wonder if Uzbekistan are going to be able to stand up to that physical onslaught. We will find out together. Right, we'll put a pin in Group K then. We come back on the other side. We're talking about Group L and finally giving Dean a chance to talk about England. Stick with us. Welcome back to the final part of Ranks AFC and the final group we are getting to in our previews, Group L, which includes England, Croatia, Ghana and Panama. Dean, you've waited through four episodes to get to this one. Tommy Tuchel's Three Lions, off you go.
Here we go, mate. It's coming home. Very excited about finally bringing this trophy back onto English soil. The finals July 19th. The trophy should be back in England on July 20th. My sister's birthday, actually, so that'll be a really nice day. I'll fly back for that one. The time is now, Jack. Our German leader ready to inspire. We're all behind him. Let's see what he can do. Obviously, there is some doubts, Jack, about whether England can do this.
I wasn't sure that was just completely tongue-in-cheek or only semi.
60 years of hurt, Jack. 60 years of hurt. 1966, we won this trophy. Haven't got it back. Tuchel, I don't know which way this goes. Either the entire country turns against him by the end of the group stages, or he does what he did for Chelsea when he took over and led them to the Champions League. The one thing I do like about him is he's single-minded and he's not... I don't think he'll be affected by the outside noise. I think Gareth Southgate tried not to be, but still was. And you've got to be your own person. And we've already seen that he's done that in the squad that he's chosen, with leaving the likes of Foden and Palmer at home, and a couple of the picks that he's made that perhaps others wouldn't have made. Our starting 11 is as good as anyone's. I'm not in any doubt about that. What isn't as good as anyone is the mentality of the team. In the group stage, we'll be fine to get out of the group. But as things progress, once you get to the quarterfinal and a potential tie against Brazil, then that's when the doubts start to creep in among us as fans and among these players. I don't know about Tuchel. I don't know about Tuchel because he's German and they have a stronger mindset and a more belief in themselves when it comes to these moments. And to be fair, a lot of this English team do have a better mindset than my generation, because they've managed to get to two consecutive finals. And before that, the quarterfinals and semifinals had kind of been as far as we'd been able to take things. So I do think that we've got chances. I think that having a few Arsenal players in there might help. I think the biggest caveat is going to be how many goals Harry Kane scores at this tournament. Does he become the Golden Boot winner? Are we just literally reliant on him being the one that delivers? Or are we getting people weighing in from other positions? I think that the squad that he's used and players like Jordan Henderson being included in it aren't a bad thing. Jordan Henderson can 100% be trusted. If you want to play him against Panama in the third group game, absolutely fine. If you want him to come on for 20 minutes to take control of a game when you're 2-0 up in a knockout game, fine. The balance of the squad is actually pretty good. It's just, do they believe in themselves? Do they let the outside noise get to them? Will there be any in-house friction? And there's potential for all of those things to become a problem. I really hope Jude Bellingham can deliver what we think he's capable of. I think that would be defining if he could do that. We know the potential's there, but we also know that England tend to have near misses rather than go on to achieve success. Kane's leadership, Kane's goal threat is basically what I believe everything will come down to in terms of the players that Tuchel picks to try to take us to glory.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's that question, right? Is it over-reliant on Harry Kane? Is it Kane or bust? The question is there and the question hangs over it, but it's not a bad question to have when you're talking about the most informed centre forward in the entirety of Europe last year, right? Like a man who banged in goals for fun left, right and centre. There is, I suppose, a slight question of when you're not working with the electric talents of Luis Diaz on one side, pulling defenders left, right and centre, Michael Olise on the other, who they have to double mark at all times. If you're getting the same amount of, you know, freedom perhaps to exploit and you're still getting the same amount of service in there. But that's not to suggest that England's wing options aren't of quality. They're just not Michael Olise and Luis Diaz, which is fine. Not many people are. That, I think, for me is the interesting one. How is that service look? The rest of his team looks very solid. The spine looks really, really strong at this point. That midfield engine room looks as strong as it's been in a long time. And it feels like that balance is there this time around. Jordan Pickford, as you say, never let England down in terms of a major tournament. I do think that all the pieces are in place. The question is going to be how England kind of deal with all of the different elements in the equation regarding, as you say, mentality, regarding the fact that there aren't as many game changers perhaps as there have been in squads in recent campaigns. You know, it's Cole Palmer that comes off the bench and scores a goal in the Euros final to bring England level. Now they lose that game, sure, but you know, that's the moment that brings everyone back together. And suddenly you're kind of looking at it and saying, well, who's that player going to be? Is that Anthony Gordon? I'm not sure. As much as the move to Barcelona can be explained by stylistic things and all of these different elements, that's all fine. But is he going to be able to have the same kind of impact as someone like a Palmer did do in the last time? And look, Cole Palmer's not in form. Phil Foden's not been in particularly good form. I think leaving them out is a perfectly reasonable decision. I'm not kind of arguing that he's made a wrong call on any of this, but there's a lot of things to manage with England. And I think that, you know, that game against New Zealand at the weekend, which wasn't particularly pretty, job done, 1-0 win, fine, learning how to play against a low block, which England are going to encounter at various points during this tournament, fine, no bother in terms of actually getting that done, but it wasn't a particularly inspiring performance. And I think that public sentiment can turn pretty quickly on this England team, as we've seen in tournaments gone by. That hasn't affected them necessarily. They weren't particularly good to watch at the Euros, but they found a rhythm that carried them all the way to the final. It's not always been pretty, but they've been there or thereabouts. The question is now, can they get over the line? And it's all eggs in the kind of Thomas Tuchel, Harry Kane basket to make sure that that happens and that England actually are there when the moment counts this time.
Yeah, exactly. Look, Gordon playing ahead of Foden and Palmer, like maybe he sees Gordon as a starter and didn't see those two as starters. If I was to pick one that would come on and win you a game or get you back on even terms, Gordon's third out of those three for me. But perhaps he sees Gordon as a starter, whereas he doesn't see those other two starting games. And I can see that across the course of a season, why you might believe that. But that's why I think that leaving Foden or Palmer out is a problem, just because I really believe that either of those is more likely to conjure up a moment in the final 15 minutes of a game that gets you into extra time or gets you a winning goal that gets you over the line. We'll have to wait and see how much that matters, mate. But it depends really on how evenly poised these England games are. Like, are they going to be cagey or are we actually going to go and assert some dominance?
Well, I suppose the question we're about to find out the answer to, but it's a very, very interesting one, no matter how this plays out. Plenty of debates across the park, but we will see how Tuchel feels his England is going to go about their business in this tournament. And we'll have a better idea of things from that point next week. Who he plays in the 10 as well is becoming a wild source of speculation in some regards. And to be honest, the idea that, you know, we had a comment like this on our Patreon in the hot take segment, we're looking at it being like, why are people arguing about this? Thomas Tuchel has been pretty clear that, you know, Morgan Rogers and Jude Bellingham are scrapping for that shirt and either of them could start for the last sort of four camps. Like, and now people are like, this is disgraceful. But like, we've not watched what's happened. Like, this has been a key element of his entire tenure. And for the most part, it's worked. So, you know, I think that there is that kind of questioning before things even begin, which is a strange place for them to be. There is less questioning when they come to England's first opponents in the form of Croatia. This is a team slightly in transition, I would argue, Dean. Zlatko Dalic has now been there for a long period of time. He has a very experienced core of players, which he can call upon. And Livakovic has been there for a long, long time. Csillessar has been there for a long time. Gvardiol came in the last World Cup and was excellent. Kovacic, Modric, Stanisic. You could see these players, Perisic, Budimir, Kramaric. There are so many names that we know from the World Cup's gone past. And even though they're in this kind of period of changing things up a little bit, it's quite easy to forget that Croatia came third in Qatar in 2022, second, obviously, in 2018 before that. Writing them off at a World Cup feels like a fool's errand, even if this team is perhaps seeing the end of its golden generation and the kind of start of a transition into a new kind of era.
Yeah. It feels like we've seen this team for 20 years, doesn't it? In some respects, I think we actually have. But one last dance, mate. I mean, they're certainly not as scary as they have been as an England fan facing Croatia I'm never super optimistic about it, and I don't particularly like that this is our first game, because I definitely think there's a chance we don't beat Croatia. But equally, I think there have been better versions of this team. So I'm trying, from an England fan perspective, to be optimistic that we see them off. But their experience is absolutely key, because they know how to stay in games. They know how not to get overrun. They know how not to be overwhelmed. And these are characteristics in a World Cup finals that are absolutely key. You know, even if Croatia go ahead in the game, they're not going to get excited about it. They're going to go straight back to whatever the game plan was in the first place. And that is a key strength that is absolutely going to exist within them for this tournament. I expect them to go through with England from this group. Can they surprise everyone by going deep and like making a run to the semi-final? I personally don't think so. But equally, from a technical perspective, they're very strong. From an experience perspective, they're very strong. It's just they're not that sexy. I think that's probably the thing that's missing. Where's the X factor? I'm not sure.
I think this is the thing, right? They were very sexy 8 years ago when they got to the final and everyone was like, wow, this team. And then 4 years ago, people were like, oh, bit done with this. And then they ended up getting to a semi-final, losing said semi-final and winning the third place game against the kind of sexy team of that World Cup in Morocco, right? And so this time out, it's a question of where are they at right now? But one of the things I think is really interesting about Croatia is how they're going to line up, because we saw them utilize, you know, the kind of standard 4-2-3-1 that we've seen from them for so many years through most of qualification. And then Vuskovic came in and has obviously had an incredible season at Hamburg on loan from Spurs. And you're looking at it and going, okay, this is interesting. He's moved to a three at the back. How does that work when Josko Gvardiol comes back in? Questionable. You're going to play him as a wing back? That doesn't necessarily add up to me. So you're going to drop someone like Chaleth Sar, who's been part of this team for such a long period. If they did, and they went Gvardiol, Vuskovic, and then Josip Sutolo, who I think is a really, really talented young player, that's a very good back three, as far as I'm concerned. You could play Perisic out on that sort of left wing back position. Yes, getting on, but still very, very talented and still been a massive, massive success in his return back to home. But you kind of look at it and think, well, where are they all kind of changing this up? And how is it all going to work together? Because for me, you're looking at it and thinking, well, if Ante Budimir leads the line, he is the kind of quintessential number nine, hold the ball up, like a lot of fun to watch. He's been brilliant for Osasuna for so many years. They've also got Matanovic, who plays for Freiburg, who is effectively just, you know, Budimir light effect at this point, right? He's kind of knocked around in Germany for a long time before finding himself a bit of a home at Freiburg. He feels like the kind of player that could maybe change things. Ivanovic at Benfica has been a slightly different prospect in that he's a bit smaller, a bit sharper, someone that's a bit more of a poacher inside the box. Loves running with the ball, could potentially play as one of those kind of tens behind if they did go to that three at the back system. You're assuming it's going to be Modric and Kovacic. If they do add a third midfielder and it goes back to that four, Petar Sucic has had an excellent, excellent kind of start to life in a Croatia shirt, has really started to make his mark as well at Inter. You've got Luka Sucic, his cousin, who's playing a Real Sociedad, who plays a little bit further forward. There's also the options of someone like a Baturina, who I think is an absolute star in the making. Has played a little bit as a nine for Como this season, but I tend to think that he would play a little bit further back. Tony Fluk, who stayed in Croatia with Rijeka in order to make sure that he got into this World Cup squad. He was player of the year last season in Croatia, was offered big moves, was like, no, I need to play first team football. I need to be in this World Cup squad. It's paid off. He is in this World Cup squad and he's going to potentially be one of those contestants to play in that number 10 spot. So there's a lot of talent here. There's a lot of young players who are you know, able to step in and potentially kind of kick onwards, especially in those attacking positions, to take over from the old guard if there is need for rotation or if it looks slightly different. And I think that there's plenty of players who can step in to that midfield as well. One of the ones that I've been really intrigued by is Nicolò Moro, who's, again, just been a key cog for Bologna quietly for quite a long period of time. He's, you know, has the ability to go both ways, very much a box-to-box number eight, can do the defensive stuff, can also pick a pass. There's a lot of players here that I look at and think, yeah, this is a very, very talented squad. Whether the fact that they're in transition from that old generation to the new one, look, I think we're going to see a lot of these players retire from international football at the end of this World Cup. I think this is the last we probably see of Modric. This is probably the last we see of Perisic. This is probably the last we see of someone like a Kramaric. They've all been massive parts of this generation beforehand. How that kind of shakes out and what we see from it going forward is a different question. Kind of, you know, bring it all together one more time, blend the old and the new for one last crack at the whip, it feels like, under Zlatko Dalic. I wouldn't rule it out, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. There's still opportunities there for people as well, exactly that. I mean, the thing I would say about Croatia is, I wonder if Ghana end up beating them, mate. I mean, that's the thing that a lot of this will come down to in terms of them qualifying. I know we're about to talk about them, but game three of this group is Ghana against Croatia. And I think actually a lot could come down to that.
I mean, the problem is with Ghana is that we have absolutely no idea because Carlos Queiroz took over in April. And they've got to this point here where you're like, what is this Ghana team at this point? And look, there's a lot of familiar names within this setup, right? And there's a lot of very, very talented players. And, you know, if Semenyo and Kudus and Inaki Williams all play together in a front line, well, wow, that's, you know, as talented as you could possibly ask for, right? Like that is quality dripping out of those areas. And that's without including someone like a Kamaldeen Sulemana, who is still very, very capable. Abdul Fatawu, who's had a weird season, obviously, with Leicester City as they were relegated. And you look at, you know, the options that they have in these areas, alongside the kind of old guard of someone like a Jordan Ayew, you're looking at it and thinking, there's no reason this side can't be really, really strong again. You're looking at players like Ibrahim Sulemana, who's had a very good campaign at Cagliari. You look at someone like young Caleb Jurenki, who's had an incredible breakout season with Nordjylland in Denmark and feels like he's someone who, whilst he's played a lot of right back for Ghana over the course of it, is stepping into that midfield and potentially making a real impact in that kind of regard. I'm just a little bit confused about what this is going to look like. And dealing with the midfield conundrums, dealing with the situations at fullback, who starts in these wide areas, who starts in this midfield duo, is going to be maybe more important than the talent that they do have in that final third, which we're all very, very aware, you know, what it's capable of doing. Equally, you're looking at it and be like, is there a base for that to work from? And right now, my hunch is that I'm not sure, especially with such a late change of management.
Yeah, obviously a lot on him. 73 now, Queiroz. But one thing you can't doubt is his pedigree in football. He's worked everywhere, all sorts of different parts of the world, all sorts of different team units, club units, national teams. So he knows what he's talking about. And as part of that, he's going to get respect. You would expect that he is going to be able to put together a strong 11. And then I wonder what comes next. I think that that's probably my concern. But with the goal power that they should have, I quite fancy him, mate. Like in Semenyo, they've got like one of the most informed players in the Premier League. And like as soon as you've got that, you're in a great position. Like Semenyo's going to score an important goal, in my opinion, in either the England game or the Croatia game. Like he will be desperate to do that. He's had such a good year, first with Bournemouth, then going into Man City, genuinely one of the players of the year. But they haven't got to play those until their second and third fixtures, and they get to play Panama first. So if they get that Panama game done, if they can get the 3 points in the bag, they know they're not far off qualifying for the next stage. And I think they'll certainly give England a run for their money. And even if they don't manage to get anything out of that game, they'll carry on into the next one and believe that they can get something. So, yeah, look, if their strongest 11 is fit enough, then I give them a decent chance of getting out of this group. I don't think they're going to go deep beyond the 32 or anything like that, but I do give them a chance of getting out of this group.
I'd love to be hotter on Ghana because there's a lot of players that I really like within this setup. But actually, you know, when I kind of try and boil it down and I compare where they're at in their development to, you know, the other teams that I'm looking at and thinking, yeah, there's a deep run to be had here. And especially when you're comparing them to the rest of the CAF contingent, right? I've been super hot on Morocco. I was relatively hot on Algeria. I'm absolutely flying on Cote d'Ivoire at the moment, who I just think are going to be a heap of fun. Senegal are a really, really well put together side. And I just get to Ghana and I'm like, I don't know what you are yet. I don't understand what you're quite trying to be. And I don't think you know really either. And it just feels like they're changing and chopping in terms of the managers in order to try and get something out of this group, which should be producing more at the sharp end of the pitch. I'm just not hugely, hugely seeing it. And I think that they might struggle in terms of putting this all together. I hope they don't. I really do think that this could be a difficult tournament for the Black Stars. Which leaves us, Dean, with Panama. And a lot of people writing them off as the kind of bottom seed of this group. I'm not sure, if I'm honest. Thomas Christensen's done a really good job. He's been there for 6 years now. He has turned them into a very well-drilled defensive unit. They work well together. And the kind of image I have in my head, if you'll allow me to pull a comparison, is I think they might be a little bit like the Costa Rica of 2022. And you'll remember that Costa Rica side were battered 7-0 by Spain in their first game. And then randomly 4 days later, we're like, oh, okay, and beat a Japan side that everyone was really, really hot on, who had beaten Germany in the opener. And then they put up a really good fight. They ended up losing 4-2 to Germany in that final game of the group stage, but looked like a completely different team. And whilst I do worry for Panama generally in terms of how this group might end up with a couple of scorelines not going their way, I do think that in games that maybe are a little bit tighter than perhaps against England, who I think will just have too much for them. Obviously, we saw them win 6-1 in Russia. That was now 8 years ago. But you look back at it and think, well, has loads changed? And we say, yeah, England have probably got a fair bit better, if I'm honest. But you're looking at it and thinking, is this a side that maybe can cause a little bit of damage elsewhere and build up that confidence? Because it felt like last time they were very, very happy to be at the World Cup. This time, to me, it feels like there's the ambition to earn those first points and that they actually belong very much on this stage now.
Yeah, they're going to try and just make life hard for teams. England might even find, you know, the other day, obviously, they've played New Zealand and only beaten them 1-0. Wouldn't surprise me if Panama tried to take that kind of approach into that game, but England should be expecting to beat Panama convincingly. Croatia should be expecting to see them off, and Ghana will see it absolutely as an opportunity. So what is the capabilities of that team? Nicking a goal here and there and trying to keep it tight? Like, it's not going to be expansive. It's not going to be exciting, but I guess there is a chance for them to look at it as an opportunity. As I said before, they'll sit themselves behind the ball. They'll make sure that they're organised. And when they get the chance, they'll rattle teams and make it uncomfortable for them, whether that's in challenges, whether that's by trying to turn them with long balls on the breakaway. But they're not going to be the best footballing team in this group. And so they're not going to try to out-football anyone. They've got to stick to a game plan that can actually work.
Well, I mean, I think the game plan is try and out-hustle teams in midfield. And, you know, you'll know one of these two midfielders very, very well in Anibal Godoy, who obviously plays for San Diego. He's going to be partnered by Alberto Calasquilla, who's in Mexico now, but had a very, very impressive spell with Houston Dynamo as well in MLS. There's a fair bit of MLS influence in here. There is a couple of players who I think are fun. Kadir Barria, who plays for Botafogo in Brazil, kind of exploded onto the scene, scored a brace on his debut and then scored on his Panama debut as well. People are very, very excited about potentially what he can bring to this team and this tournament. He feels like the kind of lone wild card spark in a team that's very much focused on bringing everything together and working, you know, as a unit. But I do think that pretty much the entire thing rests on the shoulders of Godoy and Carrasquilla to basically clog up that midfield and make sure that teams can't run through the middle of them.
Yeah, look, Godoy, I really like Godoy when I watch San Diego, and he's a tenacious player, good work rate and things like that. But there are levels to this game, and put him up against Kovacic or Modric or Elliot Anderson or Declan Rice, you're talking about a different game. Like there are just levels to it, and I do genuinely like Godoy as a player, but he's going to have to absolutely produce not just the game of his life, but it's going to be so demanding in that area of the field, and I don't know that he has the power to get through 90 minutes at that level against players of this caliber.
Yeah, no, I think it's a fair question. Look, it's a question we've asked of all the kind of bottom seeds in the group, right? It doesn't matter how good you are in qualification, in kind of continental matters. When you step up to the big stage, and you get three teams there who are just superior to you in terms of the quality that they have at their disposal. You know, the question is, can you step up to that level, or can you make the game so ugly that that quality doesn't matter? I guess that's about, you know, what we're kind of looking at here. Can they kind of stick it out in midfield and make sure that these games are slow and that they have that time to be organized and defensively solid behind the ball? There's a question mark over that. But I do think that if they can rock a team in this group, I think it is Ghana. I'm just not convinced that this Ghana side are all there in terms of all bought onto the same page. I think that that's not a question with Panama. We know exactly where they're going to be. We know exactly how they're going to come into this game and sort out. And look, again, on paper, this Ghanaian squad is obviously quite a lot more talented than what Panama have at their disposal. Are they together enough to make it stick? I don't know. And that's, I think, the question that we're going to look at here and say, how does a manager 2 months in pull all this together in such a short space of time? Can he do that against the big guns? Almost certainly not. Can he do it against Panama side that on paper weaker? Maybe. Underestimate them, I think, at their peril. And that's where I think that this group might get very, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's England 1, Croatia 2, Ghana 3, Panama 4 in my eyes. But obviously, we'll have to wait to see whether it's all as simple as that.
Yeah, it very, very rarely is in World Cups. And with that, Dean, we're done. There we are, 12 groups all locked and loaded.
I'm ready, mate. How are you feeling? Thursday, where are you watching that opening game?
I will be watching it at home in the bunker as I effectively go nocturnal for 6 weeks. It's going to be a very, very interesting experience. I'm looking forward to it. A lot of radio, a lot of podcasting. We're going to be in there. Got 1 week in the middle of it where I'm in the bright lights of Miami, which I'm very much looking forward to as well. But this is going to be a long, but really, really, really fun 6 weeks. And I'm really genuinely very, very excited for what we're going to see on the pitch here at this World Cup. It does feel like we've been building towards this for a long, long time. And yet it feels like it's crept up on us off the back of the season as well. So two things being true at the same time.
Yeah.
I'm just can't wait to get going and get stuck into all of these games. 104 games of football are going to be across all of them. Mate. So just really, really excited, Dean.
Yeah, make sure you stick with us on Ranks across the Patreon and stuff. Like as I say, we'll have short drops, we'll have some longer drops, we'll have reactions. We're going to be throwing out posts, getting questions from you guys. Just want to try and become as interactive as we can to make sure we all feel part of this World Cup together. So yeah, do come over to the Patreon and give us a go. But we'll obviously be here as well whenever we can.
Yes, absolutely. We will be doing some kind of broader looks, more top-down stuff here on the main feed as well. Those kind of thematic episodes that I alluded to right at the start of this one. And with that, all that's left for me to do is say a massive thank you to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
And thank you to Doogie Critchley and Austin Miller, who joined us for those first two previews as well. I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you all enjoy every single second of this World Cup rank squad, and we'll be with you every step of the way. We'll see you all very, very shortly. Take it easy. Peace.